Welcome to the Talk Birdie to Me podcast. This is Bird Dog Banner with Emily, and that's me. This is an informal but educational discussion on dog-related topics. We'll cover everything from waterfowl and upland hunting to training tips and even some controversial topics from a dog trainer's perspective. If you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe and follow me on social media at Short Hairs and Shotguns and also at Horizon Retrievers. Welcome to episode 14 of the Talk Birdie to Me podcast. Today, I am here with my good friend, Brandon Whitfield. I am super excited about this. Brandon and I have been talking about doing a podcast together forever, and this is part of the reason why I started this. So we've got a pretty big range of topics we want to discuss today, but let's start with an introduction from Brandon. He is a amateur dog trainer, but very experienced and very knowledgeable dog handler. He has a very analytical mind, and I have a huge appreciation for the way he thinks about things and discusses different topics and conveys those opinions that he has. So I'm really excited to share everything he has to talk about today. But let's start with kind of an introduction with you, Brandon, of tell me a little bit about your experience hunting and your experience with your dogs and training and whatever else you want to talk about.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Let's see. So, you know, I'm 35 years old. I had to think about that for a second. I'm 35 now. And so, you know, been around pointing dogs, you know, almost my entire life. So I was born with a all liver short hair that, you know, my dad had before that. He had a, you know, an Irish setter. I had another uncle that was into pointing dogs. He ran a lot of English pointers. They had a whole kennel full. And my grandpa had short hairs, and, you know, so pointing dogs, you know, on my mom's side,
That's so cool.
Grandpas, great grandpas, you know, like there's a lot of generations. I've got great old pictures. I think a few of them are on my Instagram where you can see them out in, you know, Iowa, Nebraska, you know, pitching a tent in black and white pictures with English pointers on a string. Yeah. So a lot of history, a lot of background with dogs. And, you know, so I was kind of grew up with them and grew up playing a lot of fetch. Our dog is a all liver short hair. You know, just right off the boat from Germany, a massive dog. I think is 105 pounds lean.
Wow.
And, you know, I could actually ride him as a kid. Like, I actually remember, like, being on top of the dog and riding him. And, you know, and so going out to the field every morning with my dad, we had a big field across the road from us. And, you know, he used to go out and train all the time, you know, whether he's doing, like, bird work or obedience work or just working on handling, quartering. You know, so I got to see a lot of that firsthand. Did a lot of like bush kicking, you know, before you're old enough to hold a gun, you can go up and flush a bird. So that's pretty cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so that kind of, you know, over the years, that's kind of what drove me down the lane of getting Jaeger, which is, you know, my oldest dog that I have right now. So he's 8 now. I know it's hard to believe he's getting old, getting gray. But
yep. Same with Blitzy.
Yeah, so that's where I went down that road of, you know, getting the all liver short hair. You know, it's a little bit of nostalgia there. You know, and I have a son, and he comes out with me, does the same things. You know, he comes out with my dad and myself. And so
I love it.
So, yeah, so it's a little background. You know, I started running NAVDA. I really enjoyed it. My family did mostly field trials. You know, so my dad was doing a lot of local field trials up north. We grew up in Joliet, Illinois, and then moved to some of the areas that were a little bit more rural outside of there, and then moved down to Decatur. And, you know, now I'm in, you know, kind of the St. Louis area,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so mostly, you know, they did a lot of like local field trialing, you know, and so that was pretty cool. You know, but I moved over into kind of the hunt test space because I think, you know, my analytical brain, you know, the way that they collect data and then use it to make decisions felt, you know, like a very interesting system. You know, so I started doing NAVDA with Jaeger, and he moved through that at, you know, pretty quickly.
Did you, sorry to interrupt, did you get Jaeger with the intention of running him in NAVDA, or did you get involved in NAVDA after you got Jaeger?
I got involved in NAVDA after I got Jaeger. So, yeah, I mean, really the intention there was buy a dog so I could go hunting more. So, you know, I, obviously at the time, you know, I'm a little bit younger, and I got really kind of sick of, you know, borrowing dogs from my uncle. definitely
Fair.
my grandpa. And those dogs came with very specific rules. I had to handle them a very specific way.
Ah,
And then
okay.
I would lose them sometimes. They're a little ornery. And when you come back to the house and you're like, "Hey, can I borrow a four-wheeler?" I'm like, "What for?" Because
Uh-oh.
I've got to go find a dog. I got to talk into a few times,
I can
more than a few
imagine.
times, So after so many years of doing that, you're just kind of like, "All right, well, maybe I'll get my own dog and I'll lose him."
There you go.
So yeah. So I end up getting him. Plus, it just opens up more opportunities, where you start hunting a lot more. You got three or four dogs. If you go on a long trip, you have
Yep.
dogs that get
Totally
injured, they
necessary.
start going down, and you start saying, "All right, well, let's add some dog power." And then all the older guys are looking at it. All right, it's time to start pulling your weight. You can't just always use our dogs.
Right.
So it's time to start building the strength. Plus, you start to see them age out. My grandpa and his brother Chuck were getting old to the point where they couldn't walk in some of the cover that we were walking in. And so
Gotcha.
they're not getting any more dogs.
Right.
And so it's like, all right, well, now I need to start building a little string myself. And, so in my family, I have uncles over in Iowa. They have wire hairs. And some
Interesting.
friends, one of my friends, is a park ranger out in Iowa, and so he has some wire hairs. And so we're about the same age, and so he's from Iowa. Really awesome guy. His name's Matt Peterson. So he got me on the wire hair train a long time ago. I hunted behind his female, who was just lights out. She was amazing.
Oh, cool.
And so that dog's always been in the back of my mind. He does a lot of waterfowling with her. And that was,
Interesting.
some of the progression, along the way. I got
Yeah.
into hunting with labs too. I've got a neighbor that lives down the road from me, Joe Thomas. He owns Canteen's kennel, so he has four labs now, and does a little bit of breeding. Does a lot of testing in HRC. A lot of his All of his dogs have HRCH titles on them. A few of
So
them,
cool.
a Grand Hunt Retriever Champion title. So, and I help him train for all this upland stuff, and he helps me train for all the waterfowl stuff. So it's
Awesome. Good
a
trade-off.
lot of fun.
So what kind of research did you do when looking at Jaeger as far as his pedigree and choosing a short hair over different breeds and such?
Yeah, so we've always had liver dogs in our family, so this is not surprising, probably. So everybody seemed to have a liver dog at some point in time. So you go back and say, "Here's the dogs that I liked," and you go and look at the pedigrees, and then you start to see the commonalities. It's like, okay, well, there's this one particular line called Potsiepen that I like. It was really readily so Potsiepen River Woods, and they're very readily available up north, right? So I saw a lot of them,
Interesting.
because. Yep, because that kennel is located in that same region.
Okay.
And so a lot of the buyers at that time, we weren't shipping dogs all over the world. It wasn't as easy to do in the 90s as it is today.
For sure.
And so I was just comfortable with those dogs. And I like the size of them. I like bigger dogs. I like dogs that run really hard too, like really leggy dogs. So that puts me in kind of a 70 to 75-pound dog. And, there's seemed like what I wanted. I saw some other dogs that were a little bit smaller and, a little bit more field trial bred.
Yeah.
And, that's just not the style that I like to hunt with. Just as a byproduct of the cover I hunt, if I was hunting shorter grasses, and a little bit more open prairie, sure. But a lot of stuff I personally have access to is just tough. I mean, it's just, you're just hunting thorns is what it feels like most days. And so the
I
dogs,
totally agree. I'm
yeah, when
still
you get,
picking thorns out of Blitz and a week later.
So you get dog that has a lot of mass and a lot of power behind them, and they just move through that stuff. They also tear themselves up a lot, so
Absolutely. No,
it's just part of the
Blitz is
game.
good for that.
So I searched around a lot for dogs that had some specific lineage I was looking for. So like Orson is a very popular dog. You see him come up in a lot of NABDA pedigrees. Rex, another one, come from that same line. There's another dog named Chance Fawn River Woods that's he's just a really striking dog. You can find pictures of him on the internet. Very accomplished. And I think he's a master hunter, has a BC and a KS title in the German system. Just a phenomenal dog. So those were some of the original dogs. I'm looking for this on a pedigree. Took
Very
me a long
cool.
time to find it.
I can
But
imagine.
I was looking for the right dog and not a dog right now.
As we
So
all should.
yeah, it's tough. To
Not
find exactly
everyone's
what
that
you're looking for.
patient.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
So how'd you
yeah,
get
so that's
involved in NAVDA?
so I think I heard about NAVDA through Ron Baim's podcast, the Honey Dog podcast, right? He gave the elevator pitch and I thought, man, this sounds really interesting. It sounds fun. You know, and so at that time, the Missouri Uplands chapter was kind of on a little bit of a lull. We weren't as quite as active as we are today. And so I went up and tested with the Spoon River chapter, you know, met a guy up there named Randy. He's awesome. He was their test secretary, kind of spent a lot of time on the phone walking me through the logistics of, you know, how the test works. And I just kind of went in and read the rules and went, seems pretty reasonable. Seems pretty simple. You know, so I just showed up with my dog and I was like, all right, well, I'm gonna run it.
Heck
You know,
yeah.
we had a ton of fun, a ton of fun running that first test. And you know, and then,
I'm
you know,
assuming that was
eventually,
natural ability, right?
yeah, it was natural ability. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And, you know, and then I met Fred Rice. You know, I emailed the chapter and Fred Rice happened to answer the email and was driving back from your neck of the woods, called me and said, hey, you know, I'm revamping this chapter. What skills do you have?
Heck
Like
yeah.
skills.
So for everyone who doesn't know, Fred Rice is the Blitz's breeder with Sundance. So that's kind of how Brandon and I got connected, was essentially through Fred and Sundance short hairs and Blitz.
Yeah, Fred's awesome. Yeah, so he ends up calling me and says, hey, what type of skills do you have? I said, well, you know, I've been around dogs for a little bit. I like hunting and I'm good on a computer. And he
There you
was like,
go.
perfect. You can be my IT guy. I said, sounds great. And so we just started to kind of rebuild the chapter and, you know, figuring out how to get access to websites and Facebook pages and get online payments stood up and just kind of, and we, you know, and then grew the chapter from there. Just an influx of absolutely awesome people started showing
Awesome.
up, you know, and then Fred kind of pushed me into utility. And he said, hey, why don't you run this? And I was going to run UPT because I was like, oh, it's just the next level
Fred's
and I'll
good
just
for
keep running
that.
them. And I said, I'll just run them one at a time. And he's like, why wouldn't you just run UT? And I'm like, I don't know. He's like, nobody's going to care if you fail. It's not like they're going to say you have a junk dog. I'm like, this was, by the way, this is like 14 days before the test.
Oh,
Yeah,
plenty of time.
Jaeger wasn't steady. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll just move up. And, you know, I hadn't force fetched him. I hadn't done any of the very traditional, you know, I didn't go through the very traditional like training that you see a lot of the training days with a lot of the chapters, you know? And so I just said, all right, well, I guess I'm going to try it. And, so I moved up from UPT to UT and then ended up getting a prize one, punching an invitational ticket. And so, and
That's
from
so
there you
cool.
have 365 days until you run the invitational.
So he wasn't steady?
Not 14 days before the test, no. No, he's broke to shot, which is how I hunt. You know, I
That's
generally
fair,
don't
yeah.
yeah,
And so
and
you
I
had
wasn't
that
gonna
cleaned
put
up in 14 days.
yeah.
That's really impressive.
Pigeons. Working with I have a friend who owns this Trophy Time Outdoors. He runs a preserve and a kennel and he does a lot of dog training. He's like my upland friend that he's just awesome to work with. You know, and he can really see right through a dog and just kind of say, hey, here's what I think's actually happening. And
So cool.
like 9 out of 10 times he's right. You know, and so him and I just sit down together and we run a setup and, you know, and maybe you know, we get a bad outcome, meaning like the dog pops or, you know, dog breaks. It's like, okay, let's manipulate the environment around him. You know, it's so like maybe instead of throwing that pigeon right in his face, I pick that launcher up and I move it back 10 yards and then I launch it or 20 yards even. And all of a sudden the
Very
dog's real
savvy.
steady. I can stop him with a low, right? Or I can touch him on the e-collar just a little bit, right? And it's like, okay, well now if I launch it in his face, I know that he's going to break 10 out of 10 times and that e-collar does absolutely nothing. He's done. But if I move that bird back, right? So I manipulate that environment around him, right? And I start saying, okay, well, now what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get that bird to launch right in his face, right? And so I start at 20 yards, 10 yards, 5 yards until I can move that. So that's the only variable that I'm going to try to adjust, you know, and then cueing the dog that it's a setup, right? Like, hey,
Absolutely.
you, when I
Absolutely.
walk in, I take a quick pause and he's like, ah, I know that's the, you know, that's the cue for don't move. Where when I'm hunting, there's no pausing, I'm going right in.
That's a really, really savvy move there for sure.
Yep.
So
Yep.
is that
So,
who you worked with pre? I mean, is it obviously if you're not following the stereotypical NAVDA training regimen per se, is that who you were training with before?
yeah, so I did a lot of my training during the week too. So I would just grab a Friday morning, and I would just go drive up there. We'd do a little bit of training. I could work remotely at that time, and so I'd work the rest of the day at his
Awesome.
grounds.
Awesome.
Yeah, and so plus we get along really well, Josh and I do. So a lot
That's
of
so
times we're in the
important.
field laughing a ton, having a lot of fun with it. You know what I'm saying? It's not serious. You don't get upset when the dog's doing the wrong thing because he's been doing this so long. It's like, and I've been around dogs long enough that I just expect them to not do the, I expect them to follow their genetics and not my orders, right? So it,
That's key when we're talking about bird dogs in particular, for sure.
yeah, because a lot of times I'm trying to stop them from doing something that we have like 1,000 years of like gene code that's programming them to do.
100%.
Yeah, so it shouldn't be easy. It's not supposed to happen quickly.
When you go in with that mindset, it's a completely different game for sure. So you went to the Invitational. What did your training look like between your utility to the Invitational?
So I hunted real hard that year.
Heck yeah.
And Jaeger and I were duck hunting a ton. We went on a handful of road trips. We're in up and down to North Dakota twice, South Dakota, went to
Awesome,
Iowa, had a great
awesome.
time. This is pre-kids, so
Right,
I've got a lot more
fair.
free time. And then duck hunting, we were goose hunting. He retrieved a lot of geese that year, did a lot of ice water work, which we can talk about later,
Yeah,
running a
for
short hair in
sure.
ice water, different blind setups. We took him on snow goose hunting, which was really fun watching him,
Oh, I'd
mark a
love to
snow
do that
goose.
with Glitzy.
Yeah, he had some great retrieves, like 350 yard plus, where the snow goose was basically a dot, and
Sore.
you see him. Oh yeah. If
Saw
you've
that a
never
lot
seen
in
a 70,
Canada.
yeah, if you've never seen like a 75-pound dog hit a snow goose at 30 miles an hour,
Heck yeah.
it's fun, and then just haul it back.
Right.
So yeah, he had a real great time doing that, and so we come out of snow goose season, and now all of a sudden it's June before I'm really starting to prep because I like hunting, really enjoy the hunting aspect of it, and I don't do this just for the testing. The testing is something I do for fun,
As it should
and
be,
then it kind of levels up me and levels up the dog, keeps us
of
sharp together,
course.
so we work a lot better in the
Love
field when
that
we're hunting.
perspective.
Yep. And so I didn't have a lot of time for prep, so I think I in my field work, right, so we're working on continuation of steadiness. His retrieve was pretty solid by then. We're working a little bit of marking, working blinds, and then working and backing, honoring.
Did he already have a handle?
No. Yeah, I didn't have a
Your
lot of time to build
face.
it either.
So you. Okay, let's talk about this then. You did not force fetch him. What was your
No.
process of putting a handle on a dog without force fetching him?
Yeah, so we go back into why I didn't force fetch. It's like just pretty simple. Like he retrieved fine. And so anytime I shoot a bird, I'd recall him, right? It's not like he's gonna come perfectly back to me. Like he was parading as a puppy.
Of course.
I bolted a nice recall on him that would get him to me, and he wouldn't drop the bird, right? And so I'd say heel, and he healed around. He's still holding it. It's like,
Heck
okay,
yeah.
what So I didn't have time to do it, so obviously, like there's situations where we ran into like big geese, massive Canadas, that he's retrieved back, comes up a 1 foot ramp that's wobbly, and he's dropping the bird, or he's really hot, and can drop a bird. So like I don't have that type of like, hey, if you drop it, there's gonna be negative consequences. There's a correction put on you. So some form of punishment. So like, can he make mistakes? Yeah, sure. But I don't think in most of those tests we're doing anything so complicated that it's going to
Would
expose him.
warrant it.
Yeah. Plus, I just didn't have the time. It's like I got 14 days. I'm like, well,
It is
Cooper
what it
Utility.
is.
Yeah, I'm just going to take whatever I have, pass it. Okay. We weren't perfect. We were above the standard, you know? So then, you know, kind of going to the invitational again, it's like I got limited time. And if you've never started to try to do a 100-yard blind with a dog that does not want to genetically run straight,
Oh, God.
right? Like, I'm not doing a force fetch program in that time and then
No.
putting blinds in on top of it.
Mm-mm.
So I started working with my neighbor who's, you know, he's very experienced in running blinds. His dogs run beautiful blinds. You know,
Of
I mean, I
course.
think I saw his 10-year-old female Mossy, who was just the best dog, the best waterfowl dog I've ever hunted behind by a wide margin.
Awesome.
She's just amazing. So she was the dog that we had hypothermia on.
Oh, gosh.
So yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit because I know you just had a run in with that recently.
Yes.
And so, you know, I mean, she's 10 years old, taking no casts, you know, 120 yards on land, stepping on them. You know, I mean, so
Awesome.
he, it, when it comes to like, and he doesn't force fetch either. So I was kind of
Really?
like,
So he,
hey,
all these, all his HRCH dogs are not force fetched.
not a single one, no.
Interesting. I would love to talk about that. Okay.
Yeah, and hey, look, they make mistakes, but these mistakes aren't severe. Like when we're hunting, if a dog drops a bird, we're like, whatever.
You're right.
You know,
Do you
especially
ever have
coming
any
back
issues with
into
cripples?
no.
Okay.
Nope. Most of the time the dogs snatch onto them. You know what I mean? Like half of the battle is just actually getting them. You know,
Yeah.
when they're diving around, it's the persistence in water, you know, and you're
Yeah.
kind of looking at the clock going, if you don't, you know, shoot them on the water after, you know,
Yep.
you're looking at the clock going, all right, we've been out there 3 minutes, like, you know.
Yep.
So you know, as long as the dog can get a hold of it, and after they work that hard, they're not letting go of the bird. They're
Fair.
snatching on
Okay.
that thing. And
Fair.
if they're experienced walking up the ramp, meaning they don't mind the wobbly ramp, his dogs are a lot smaller than mine,
Yeah.
you know, 50, 55 pound
That's the easy crit
females.
then for them.
Yep, they come up, they get in the blind. And then, you know, I mean, I'm right there. There's hands right underneath them. They drop it. I grab it, bring its neck in.
Okay.
It goes on the lanyard.
Okay,
So.
so back on track. What was your method for running blinds with Jaeger then?
So I think step one was, you said, what's a perfect blind, right? It's like I'm able to line my dog up, right? And like understanding what a good, like lining a dog up correctly is, meaning it's
Yeah.
like I'm not facing left, I'm not facing
Yeah.
right? So like the spine to the nose of the dog is a very in line. It's like step
Yep.
one is just getting the dog pointed in the right direction.
Yep.
Then you have the send, and then you have the pickup and the return, right? So like you only have to handle when things are going off the rails,
Correct.
right? And so generally, if you can get a dog lined up and they'll run infinitely in a direction until they hear that pick it up whistle, that's perfect blind, right?
Yep.
So like most of the training was how do I stretch a dog out and get him lined up correctly, right? So
Yep.
that's the goal. You find out really quickly that pointing dogs are
Not labs.
genetically inclined to use the wind and other things at their advantage. You know, and so they're not going to stay on a line quite as long as maybe a lab, right? There's cooperation in there. So I'm, you know, there's
Absolutely.
uncooperative labs
Yeah.
that will certainly break off that line.
Yes. But
Then
whenever.
there's absolutely uncooperative short hairs or wire hairs or whatever that will do that. And then there's cooperative wire hairs who will stay on the line longer than the lab, you know? So the genetic makeup I had specifically was he's very independent and is very big running. And it's the second that you send him, it's going to be maybe 7 foot, you know, seven
Yes.
strides, and
Yeah.
he's starting to come off of that line. So
Yep.
then it's a, okay, like what, how do I take that 20, that first 20 yards where he's going to run
And
straight,
stretch
and
it
I turn that
out.
into 40
Yep.
or into 50. And then once you get to a point where you're like, I just can't hold the line for 200 yards, you know, or 100 yards, whatever it is, there's certain conditions that would pull him off. So
Of
I'm
course.
setting up situations where I'm asking him to do like poison birds.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's like a,
Smart.
yeah, so poison birds are in the sight category, but there's a lot of different things. So there's like, what are distractions? You know, so there's like scent, there's sight, there's sound, right? So imagine a dog's running a line and all of a sudden I hit the beeper on a launcher that a dog's heard 100 times. He knows that there's
Right, and know
pigeons involved.
exactly what it is.
See ya, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna ask him to and go through the conditioning process of like, no, hey, you're only going to
There's
be
no line.
successful if you stay on that line, because you and I have to have trust. And that's a big thing. It's like, I'm not teaching him to run straight. I'm teaching him to trust me.
That's a great way to put it.
And so a lot of that was, and that's, that was the conversation that I had with my neighbor Joe, and we're, I'm going, what are we teaching him? And it was always trust. You have to trust me. That's what we're teaching. And hey, by the way, if he decides he wants to peel off early, sounds great. You're not going to be productive,
Right, you're not
because
getting
we
it
have went
rewarded for
through
that.
with the, the 20 other dogs that we have. This is a sanitary environment, right? There's no
Gotcha.
other birds. There's no other fun to be had, right? Like, there's no animals on the ground. We know that you're not going to be productive if you leave this line. So when they do, they get tired. All right, come on back in.
Let's
Have a
try
seat in
again.
the kennel, buddy. When you want to start trusting me, you'll be successful really quickly.
So did you ever end up teaching him to cast in that time frame, or was it just you've got to trust me and run straight, and that's where you're going to get rewarded?
Yeah, so the first part is the trust, right? It's like you have to, so like step one is just trust me to run in a straight line. And then sometimes things happen, right? Like, maybe there's a log in their path, right? These are totally reasonable things. Like he may, all of a sudden like bend out just a little bit as a byproduct of running the terrain, right? So you run over a hill and he's not going to go perfectly straight. It
Of
just
course
doesn't work
not.
like that. And so then it's, can I get you to stop? Right? Do you trust me enough to stop your progress and listen to me? Right. And so I do that with like a bumper throw, just straight up like, hey, if you hit the brakes, I toss you a bumper. Right. Jaeger
That's how
loves
I know
retrieving.
this
That was a,
whistle sits for sure.
that was a fun game. Yeah. And we did, I didn't do the whoa. I did the whistle sit, turn around, face me. Cause, that's where you get the highest accuracy in your
Of
casts.
course.
So we were doing games with, mats, so wake up in the morning, he goes to the
I
bathroom.
remember those videos you sent me.
Yeah, we're hitting mats, and we're just doing three-way casting, right? Just the basics. And everything was a game. And if it's a game and it's fun and there's not a lot of consequences, I can stack a lot of attrition on that.
And that's an important thing. Will you repeat that for all the short hair owners out there? Because I feel like that is really a substantial piece of advice right there.
Yeah, so we went from doing that with mats to just learning it's easier to stop a dog that's running away from the motivating object, right? Whatever's motivating them. So, maybe you set a duck right behind him and then you recall him to you, and then you hit the whistle, and they're going to stop a lot easier than they would if they're running towards it and you ask
Of
them to stop
course.
progress.
Of course.
So, learning some tricks like that along the way, and then just as long as you can get him. So I think my strategy is, and still to this day, even when I'm hunting, is if I can get you on the right side of the wind, I've got a good bird dog and he's coming home with the bird.
Of
So
course.
I'm not going to try to put you on the object, and I'm, because I have a lot more grace running like an ABDA and when I'm hunting than say if I'm running at the Grand, right?
Yes, that's the
Yep. So the
truth.
Grand's a whole nother beast, but for what I'm doing, I want to make sure that you're going to stay on the line, but if you're going to break off the line, I want you favoring the wind.
Of course.
Now, I want to still keep you in a driveway, right? Meaning, you got like 15 feet-ish to play with, where I'm not going to stop you. I'm not going to, pinball you back and forth. But as long as you're on the right side of the wind, we're good. Now, you get into water, and that changes things, because sometimes wind creates waves and white caps. And sometimes it's raining and you're still gonna have to hunt. I'm hunting in the rain. I love
Of
hunting in
course.
the rain. I
Of
have my
course.
best hunts in the rain.
The
So
docs
my
love the
dogs get,
rain.
yeah, when it's nasty out, we're going out and throwing bumpers. And when you're
Smart.
running a
Makes sense.
blind, if you let that current blow you off of, blow, kind of blow you out of the driveway, I want to see him fight it. Right? If you trust me so much that you're gonna fight those white caps, you're gonna fight those waves. Stay on your line because you know exactly where you're going. But, worst case scenario, those waves are always going with the wind. And so if you do get blown off, the
You
scent of the
should
bird's going to be in your
ideally get
favor.
noted.
Yeah. So as long as he's not getting blown too far off, 15 yards, that's fine. I'm not going to worry about that personally. But if he's blown 30, 40, 50 yards off, now we have a problem,
Right, of
right? My
course.
dog's getting manhandled by the current, and so. Those are the things that, because your one thing is, Are you just not willing to fight the water, or are you in danger? You know, because one of those situations, I have to intervene. You know, so part of it is
Fair.
like, what's the dog made of? How strong are they at swimming? What are their mechanics? Right? Like, I want to know all that before I put them in cold water.
Definitely.
Yeah,
Definitely.
because I mean, some of these dogs, they'll go into, you know, they'll kind of start seeing red when they're on a cripple, and if that cripple's just swimming, you know, all of a sudden, if you don't know kind of what your dog's made out of, you don't know the signs for are they in trouble or not.
Yes, for sure.
So they can get out in an area that they're unfamiliar with, and then all of a sudden they don't know their way back.
Yep.
So, which
Unfortunately, that
happens when you're hunting
happens.
in a marsh.
Yep. Definitely.
So I definitely had to go get Jaeger a few times. He's gotten hung up on logs, and you know, where I'm like, I know this dog can move through that cover, and he hasn't came back already. And I've recalled him. He has
Yep.
a strong recall, and I don't run an e-collar. So, because I don't want him to get hung up, and you know, lo and behold, he gets hung up by his vest, you know, so.
Of course, it'll happen
But
for sure.
yeah, a lot of the
So,
training and stuff, it helps in those situations make the call for like, is my dog in trouble? Do I need to go help?
I could use a little bit more of that for sure in my life. So, how did your invitational go?
The field was rough, to say the least. You know, I mean, big fields. I was running in Ohio. You know, they had some pretty big fields, really hilly, and they were mowed, you know, which is like a death sentence for a guy with a fast dog.
Oh
Not
my
mowed. I mean, they had
gosh.
paths mowed in them, not
Okay.
fully mowed. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, a dog who's hunted a preserve before, like he
Oh
hits that
God.
path. We've got, you know, so I come up to the line, I think, and I air him out. There's chuckers everywhere. I'm running on Sunday with all the dogs that are in. He's chomping. His
Oh
jaws are
my
chomping.
God.
You know, but I mean, hey, look, it's like you got to hunt with dogs who are sometimes into heat, coming out of heat, right? It's like he's got to perform.
Yep.
So, you know, the chuckers on the side of the roads weren't helping. There's nowhere to air them, you know, so I'm like asking him to just pee on the gravel.
That's wild.
It's just part of it, part of the game, right? So he's wound up already. And so come up to the starting line, and I'm running with a poodle pointer. You know, I talked to that handler for a minute, and you know, they ask us, they're like, hey, why don't you come up a little bit closer, right by the starting line? So, okay. And you know, they're trying to get everybody organized. We've got gunners, we have photographers, right? I mean, you don't want to be waiting on people because we're on a time schedule. This thing can't take all day. And so I come up, and I think his name was Brent Tomlinson, and I had Clyde Vetter in my field and a few other judges, you know, so pretty experienced judging crew. And so they're like, hey, we're on a schedule, you know, and I get up and guy comes hauling on a four wheeler right past me, and Jaeger's on, like, if there is an 11th level, that's where he was sitting at. And, you know, at that point you're just kind of like, look, I know I'm in trouble.
Yeah, whatever
This
happens,
is going to be a
happens at
long
this
day for
point.
me. And so Clyde's like, hey, do you want to put him in this? You want to get him wet, you know, and kind of try to cool him off a little bit, you know, maybe take the edge off. And I'm like, I don't think I can make it on a heel to that bucket. And he kind of looked at me and he was like, all right, we're going to run him. I was like, yeah. So, you know, I cut him loose and he just takes off at like, he runs past I let the poodle pointer go first
Of course.
and then I release him and he comes by the poodle pointer at like,
Mock speed.
just, yeah. It sounded like a horse.
I can
And the
imagine.
poodle pointer just jumped off the path. Like, what is that? And he went over a hill, and then he disappeared. You know, this is very typical for him, right? When we hunt, this is what it looks like. Okay.
Course.
So if there's a gate bird, he's not catching it. You know, if I'm
Right.
running, you're running a trial with him.
Yeah.
You're not. Yeah, you're getting the back bird first with him. You hunt the front field the reverse way. So over a hill, and you know, then I don't see him, and we come up over the hill, and the poodle pointer takes off left, and we're trying to stay braced, and so we follow the poodle pointer. Jaeger had gone right and was up on the hill pointing. And Joni, my wife, was watching through binoculars. I took her halfway across the country, like 7 months pregnant. And so yeah, so she went out there with me, and so she was watching through binoculars and was trying to like call my phone. Like, hey, you're going the wrong
Nuh-uh.
way. Yeah, I mean, I had my phone on
Of
silent.
course,
So we
yeah.
just walked the wrong way for, you know, 10, 15 minutes of the beginning of the brace, and he's just standing there, just burning down. So yeah, and that was kind of the start of it. I walked in and I'm kicking around, stepped on a bird, crushed its head.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so it's just like nothing's going well.
Right.
And so that was the first bird. The second bird, all the gunners emptied their guns and didn't knock a single bird down off of a covey at like 15.
Everyone just shot into the middle of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, and they were getting up in force. So when you walk in and you see 15 sets of eyeballs, you're like, uh-oh, I don't have the pocketbooks to train for this. Like setting
For
15 chucker
sure.
coveys,
Oh my gosh.
I was flushing three, four pigeons at a time, but that's nowhere compared to that many chuckers getting up. You just walk in and you're like, well, today's gonna be rough. So we made it to the field and we ended up getting some bird shots. We got a few backing opportunities. He did well on those and did well on his retrieving. We ended up going 15 minutes. We ran 15 minutes over just because the dogs, we wanted to get more backing opportunities for both dogs. So we just extended the brace a little bit. And but overall, it was good. I had problems kind of keeping him under control
I can
because he was pretty
imagine.
turned up. Yeah, so I had to get all of our bird contacts and the retrieves in that last like half hour.
Oh my
And
gosh.
yeah, he was destined to find all the chuckers.
I can
Because
imagine.
once you see 30 or 40 of them blow up in front of you, he was in heaven. It was his favorite day, I think.
I
So
can't imagine. Oh my
yep.
gosh.
Yeah, so we came out. I talked to Clyde better after, and we were running pretty low on cooperation. Leaving the field. He said it pretty nicely, but it was a like I don't know how you pulled that off type of conversation.
Nice.
But coming into the water, that's where we have the most experience. I mean, Jaeger spent most of his life in a duck blind.
Right.
So that's where he's really gonna shine. We went through the blind, the marks, the honoring. That was the healing, and that was easy peasy. I don't think I said
Awesome.
one word to him the whole time.
Awesome. That's so cool.
So, yeah, so it rounded out to like the lowest score you can get and still pass. I think I said it to Fred on the phone and he was kind of like, you passed? And I was like, I don't know, they said pass.
It's so fast.
It's like, are you sure that the number's right? I'm like, yeah, the number's right. He's like, huh, that's wild. So yeah, Fred, he's fun. So yeah, I was talking to him. I kind of came out of the field and called him and said, dude, should I just go home?
Right.
He was
We've
like,
all been
no,
there.
you don't know how they score it. You're good. Just keep going. You don't know how they're scoring it. And I was like, okay.
Well, good
He's
thing you
always been kind
did.
of, yeah, he's definitely rooted for me behind the scenes a lot. And he's a good
Awesome.
dude.
Awesome.
So yeah, it was a fun test. We had
So
a
you
lot of good
passed
times.
your first utility and invitational prize one,
Yeah.
VC, no force fetch.
Mm-mm.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I worked with a lot of really experienced people though. I think especially, in the areas where the genetics are in the driver's seat, like I kind of understand what the dog wants to do and why he wants to do it.
That is so important.
Yep, so that makes a lot of sense to me. And then for all the things where I'm like, hey, I'm kind of going against the grain of genetics here. The people that I was working with, so like Josh Tucker and Joe Thomas, they're very helpful in their approaches, and they kind of I watched them a lot. Took a lot of
That's
time to
so
just watch them
important.
handle, and then you kind of build a plan around it and then, just put the work in.
Finding really savvy trainers like that is key. And I mean, you get lifetimes of experience from working with people like that and not just cookie cutter, run of the mill, but this is how I've always done it type of trainers.
Yeah, and they, in their lives, they're both very accomplished. Josh has got just boxes and boxes of trophies. He has just trophies from, winning trials. There was the, oh, was it the BDC that was on? They did like a field trial, TV show for a little bit that he was on. It was
Interesting.
pretty cool, yeah. So, he won, a few of the tournaments in there. So,
That's super
and I've
cool.
watched him handle. In the field in a trial, and he is smooth. You can tell some of the really experienced handlers when you
Of
watch him,
course.
just like, everything he does just looks, I mean, it's just smooth as silk all the time, the way he's handling around, and the
What a
way he
good
wheels dogs
mentor. What a
into the
good role
areas.
model.
Yeah, he kind of helped me understand, like, so there's, handling a dog into a good situation, and there's also handling him away from a bad one. Right?
Smart.
That's a, yeah,
Yes.
if you want to play the games,
That's
understanding those two sides of the
exactly
coin.
right. That's exactly right. You got to know how to play the game.
Yeah, so that helped because we definitely ran into some areas where I was like, this is a bad setup for me, and I needed to know how to handle my dog out of a
Get
bad
out of it.
situation.
Yep. When you run
And,
dogs like Jaeger, that's really important.
yeah, and just consistently hearing from the judging crews and anybody who's in the field with us, like, hey, do you run field trials? Because he really looks like he belongs there. Like, that's a nice way of saying he was on that
Borderline
11th
out of
level.
control.
Yeah, not borderline. He was out of control. But I mean, when you get a dog like that kind of under control,
It's
man,
the
that's
most
fun.
impressive.
Yeah, it's really fun, where you
Most
just,
impressive.
especially when you get out to big country, drop the tailgate and you go hunting 5 days and on the fifth day you open the tailgate, that dog's still on 10.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. It's really
Super
fun.
cool.
Guiding with him is really fun.
I bet.
A lot of people compliment him on his work ethic, just like how hard he runs all the time. Just it's nonstop.
I believe
That's
that.
fun. Getting that under control is not quite as fun.
Been there.
Managing it's
Yep.
not as fun.
Been
So
there.
he has a son. We did a breeding with him with a dog out of Trillian's kennel, so Lane. I think it's Lane Sladen now. I was gonna say Lane Jewell, that's her maiden name, Lane Sladen. She got married to Tyler, who's the hawk, the quail hawk guy.
Yeah.
So he's got a really interesting Instagram page. If you ever get the chance to go look at his stuff, it's really
Yes,
cool
for
what he
sure.
does with the dogs and the birds. He'd be a great guest. But so we did a dog breeding with her dog Tilly, and my dad has a all liver son out of the Jaeger. And he's trying to get him under control now. Struggling,
I believe
but
it.
having a great time, so it's kind of opened that back up. So now we go to the field with, my dad, me, and then my son.
So
So very
cool.
similar to the way I grew up with my
Yeah.
grandpa, my dad, and me.
With your
So
solid liver short hairs. I love it.
yeah,
That's
it's a
very cool.
disease.
So let's talk about duck hunting a short hair and your experience with that and what people need to know and when you would do it and when you wouldn't and what it takes.
Yeah, so I think there's like favorable conditions and environments for running a short hair. Just I'll talk about like the most fun that I have is early season, so teal season.
Heck yeah.
That's the most fun, and I'm hunting in a marsh, right? So I'm a member of a duck club, and I've got a few other locations that are really marshy. And early season means I don't really have to pay attention to the temperature unless it's too hot, right? I'm looking for hyperthermia, not hypo. But generally, a lot of times teal screech in really fast and you're taking passing shots and so you'll drop them in cover and getting a dog that'll just relentlessly search
Search.
cover
Yep.
is a huge benefit. So, I mean, you have a lot of fun
Yeah.
doing that because you can leave a dog out to search for much longer in teal
Yes.
season than you can in late season duck hunting.
Of course.
So those are my favorite conditions that are really favorable for short hairs,
Yep.
As it gets colder, you may be in the same spot, with the same shot setups and the same, landing ducks in the same areas, but you're not going to be able to leave your dog in the water for that much longer. It doesn't matter whether it's a Labrador, Chessie, or a short
Yes,
hair.
please elaborate on this.
There's just safe temperature ranges, right? So, like, I mean, effectively, what you're looking for is core temps,
So you're talking
right?
about the dog's temperature, their safe temperatures. Okay.
Yep. And so, the question is like, what are the signs that you can visibly see? Because you can't just like insert a thermometer into their stomach and look at it on your phone. That doesn't exist. I wish it did. If it did, I'd
Something
pay
to think
whatever it
about.
costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it existed, I'd pay whatever it costs
Right.
and I would just use it. So now the question is like, how do I can't see my dog when they're searching. So like, I can't tell if they're too cold. And then
Yeah.
even if they're too cold and they're submerged in water, like what are the signs? I can only see the dog's nose.
Right.
There's some kind of Kentucky windage ways that you can think through this, right? It's like, what's the temperature outside? How strong is the wind? how cold is the water and how long have they been in those conditions?
Okay, repeat that
All
for me
right.
again. What's
So temperature, right? So what's
okay?
the outdoor temperature? It's like maybe it's 20 degrees out. How
Okay.
strong is the wind? A wet dog and 40 mile an hour wind. He's a lot colder than a wet dog in 2 mile an hour wind.
Got it.
If they're exposed to the wind, right?
Right, of course.
And then there's water temperature,
Yep.
being like, how cold is that water?
Yes.
And you know it's cold when you're setting decoys and you set two decoys and you're like, man, like my fingers are shutting down
Yes. Yeah. If you don't have decoy
versus,
gloves, you'll know real quick how cold that water is.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, if you're wearing, the electrician's glove that are insulated, that where you don't get wet and you're nice and warm, you're wearing a
Yes.
3-layer jacket, like you have no idea what that real temperature is.
Exactly.
So take your gloves off and
Yes.
feel it. You
Yeah.
stick your hand in the water and your fingers shut off on the first decoy. Okay.
That water
It's
temp
gonna
is
be a
cold.
cold day. Yeah. Well, and there's a difference between sheet ice and ice you have to cut with a chainsaw.
Yep.
Right?
Learn
Where,
that.
and then there's, obviously the ice you cut with a chainsaw, much colder. But if the dog can get up on the ice shelf, they can run to the bird and shake off, roll run in some snow. Where if it's sheet ice, maybe 1/2 inch thick ice, they're gonna have to break it the whole way. And that's a much more strugglesome retrieve.
Absolutely.
So, when I'm hunting, so just straight up what I found with him, so he's medium dense, medium, like a medium dense, medium harsh coat. So pretty average, pretty standard for the breed.
Yep.
75 pounds and just a relentless drive, meaning he'll get in the water even if it kills him.
Yeah.
So it's not really a lot to go off of for me, right?
Right.
Cause he's leaving the ramp if I shoot a bird.
Right, of course.
But generally I'm hunting and we'll talk about our blind setups. There's a difference between a pit, right, where I can run a heater. You're below the surface. So it's going to be warmer down there. So a lot of the times in a pit, it may be so cold outside that, I mean, your beard's freezing. But underneath the surface, I'm wearing a hoodie. I've
Really?
got a heater running. There's bacon cooking, right?
Heck yeah.
Easy peasy. So on those hunts, I can take him a lot colder. So, I mean, I'll hunt him ice water. If I can
Okay.
get him out and I can run him and really get that core temperature up, I mean, I'll run him in as cold a water as he wants to get in.
Okay, so are you saying that you'll let him go get a bird and then take him and let him run around afterwards to get his temp back up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
Yeah, because
interesting.
I mean, you have a short hair. How quick do they dry? You throw a
Yeah.
few bumpers, and let them run around. And then all of a sudden their coats are completely dry. You get them in a warm blind where they can move around back and forth. And they have it's all about rebounding your temperature, right? So like
Got
all the
it.
dogs get cold. All of them get cold going in the water. If you feel a Labrador between the legs or you stick a thermometer in them after they get out of the water, like they're in that same temperature water and it's not like it's not touching their skin,
Of course.
right?
Of
And
course.
so they're gonna get cold. Especially if they're in the water for 5 minutes, like
Yeah, will you talk a little bit about duration? Like when do you start to be alarmed that they've been in the water too long?
man, so with Jaeger specifically, it's all about the temperature, right? Those like three variables, right?
Yes.
And it's really a matter of like how cold do I think he is, and then how quickly can his temperature rebound,
Okay,
right?
so there's a difference if you're gonna warm him up versus he's not gonna get as warm right after.
Yeah, so if he's got 10 ducks to get and it's really cold, like I cut ice with a chainsaw. Right. He could be in, get some ducks, maybe two ducks, and then I'm like, hey, this guy's kind of cold, and I proactively run him on the bank. Maybe I take one of the ducks, turn behind me and throw it. He goes and gets it. He's having fun.
Interesting.
And then we're back in the water, a little bit
Interesting.
later.
Okay.
You can get into vests, right? If he's wearing a vest, it's different. You can get
Yep, of
into the type of
course.
neoprene, open cell versus closed cell. A closed cell you're going to see on really high-end triathlon wetsuits or diving wetsuits,
Okay.
where if you put it in a bucket and you step on it, you can't wring it out. It's not going to absorb water. Where like open cell, I mean, you've taken vests off the dogs and
Yep.
you've wrung them out after it's and it's
Yes.
holding a ton of water,
Yeah.
right? Like that water is very cold. So now the dog's got to warm their internal temperature wrapped in a layer of,
Cold water.
yeah.
Got
But
it.
yeah, now the vest will help you in the wind because that wind's not touching their skin. when the wind blows over that, that fur, especially on a short
Gotcha.
hair,
Yeah.
makes a difference. Where the longer haired dogs don't struggle on that
As much.
as much. Yeah. So, it's really like, what are the signs that you're looking for? Right. So like when the dog gets out of the water, are they strong on their feet?
Okay.
Right. If they're walking around, you'll see them cramping. Have you ever seen a dog take and kind of like a horse kick, kind of kick their leg back? You're like, oh, that's interesting behavior,
Yeah.
right? Kind of, it's getting too cold.
Yeah.
You can look for, like how lethargic they are, right? So like they could be kind of strong on their feet, walking normal, but they just don't seem quite on, right?
Yep.
Where, I mean, if you've had a short hair, they're typically motivated to move,
Very,
and if
very
they're not
noticeable.
moving,
Yes.
yeah, so those are signs that you got to watch out for. And then, generally, sometimes this was one of the things that we missed with the Labrador that went hypothermic, was she started to eat a bird. And this is a 2000 point
Yeah.
HRCH dog, right?
Very
They're Grand
unusual.
Hunt Retriever. Yeah. I'd never seen her do that before other than one time. And I'm just kind of like, I can't believe she's doing that, and we're yelling at her, hey, cut it
Yeah.
out, right? Her blood sugar started dropping, and there's other secondary consequences
Wow.
to her getting hypothermic. And so obviously we do honey, we supplement honey, or something that's gonna has like simple sugars in it. That was something that our vet told us
Yeah.
when we ran into that. And so if a dog is coming out of the water and starts eating a bird, like all of a sudden, a dog that's never done it before,
Yeah.
it's just an anomaly. And you just
Yep.
learn to pay attention to anomalies, right?
Yeah.
It's like behavior that we're seeing. It's like I go hunt him during teal season. I've seen the dog come out of water 100 times
Yes.
with birds, without birds,
Yeah.
right? And all of a sudden, coming out of, slightly colder water, she's acting wildly different, right? That should
Yeah.
be a sign. You need to start paying attention to the dog. Because I mean, it's not like she doesn't get food. She's well
Of
fed. She
course,
gets
of course.
snacks in the blind, like, so that's a thing I'm paying attention to with the short hairs. Just behavior, right? Just looking for like anomalistic behavior.
How
'Cause what's the
often?
trouble? I mean, if you stop and run them, like, what do you lose? Like a
Right.
few minutes,
Right.
right?
Yep.
There's no bad outcomes.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I shot 10 birds and we've got two on the water. It's like, well, they could stay there if you're worried.
Absolutely.
Don't worry about it. It's not
Yeah.
gonna, if the birds want to be there, they're gonna be there.
Yep.
You'll be fine. Save your dog.
For
So,
sure, way more important. How often do you check his temperature when you're hunting?
fifteen minutes after retrieve.
15 minutes
After,
after.
yeah. So, you'll have a problem getting it like accuracy immediately after they get out of the water because they're so cold and it's so close to the external of their body, I think was the
Okay.
reason that they
That
told
makes
me.
sense. Yeah.
So like that core temperature is not going to be accurate, right? When you do if you do it rectally.
Of course.
So I mean, obviously if you shoot a laser on their skin, that's going to be even worse.
Of
I
course.
mean, so there's
Yeah.
just not a phenomenal way to get that like real true core temperature. So I wait a little bit of time and I want to see
Okay.
him look good. Like if he's not looking good and the thermometer says he's good, I don't care about the thermometer.
Right.
But if the thermometer is like, oh, this dog's 20 degrees and he's bouncing off the walls and he's like happy wagging his tail, I'm like, maybe the thermometer's off, right? So
Yeah.
like pay really close attention to like, is the dog operating normally?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I have a, working with sensors. Yeah, so I started, I'm a software engineer. I don't think I said that on the podcast. So, I started my career working in for the military, working on a WMD, so a chemical, biological, nuclear, radiological weapons detection platform. And we had a lot of sensor integrations. And
Interesting.
so I learned a lot about sensors, along the ways. I've done some work in automotives. And so sensors go bad and they give you bad values. And so if you put two sensors on something, how do you know which one won, right? Which
Right.
one's the reading correctly?
Yeah.
And so now the best answer, or the answer that will give you the highest confidence for the least amount of money, is running three sensors, right? And so that I basically have a tiebreaker. And so the more that you add, the more confident that you can be in that
Right.
answer. And so, if you take one thermometer hunting, like how do you know it's accurate?
Right. It's a
Right.
great
So, I mean, you
point.
could use it on yourself, right? That's a trick is like before I go stick a thermometer in my dog, I'll use it on myself, put it underneath my arm,
Okay.
get my
Make sure
temperature, and
it's
if it, yep, make sure
in
it's
the right
calibrated at least.
range. Yeah.
Yep. And then we have other dogs. Sometimes we'll run two dogs when it's really cold out and we'll run them staggered. And so one dog's inside getting warm by the barbecue grill. Yeah, we have a barbecue grill in our pit
Heck
and
yeah.
also one in the blind that I have. And so the pit's easier to hunt. The stick blind that's over moving water. It's like a river style blind where you pound posts in and you build a deck over water, and then you build a basically a small house on top of it. That's way colder. Way colder. It can be 33 degrees out, and because that moving water is just sucking heat out of the blind, we'll have ice on the wood. So it's above freezing, and the inside of the blind will be icy.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so that's another thing too, is like, paying attention to like how well insulated, like how warm your actual blind is.
Interesting.
We've had dogs get back in the water, right? They're on the ramp and they're freezing. They get back in the water because the water feels warmer than the.
Oh
That's also
gosh.
another sign you pay attention. Why is this dog getting back into the water? It's the wind's
Okay.
really cold. Let him in.
Okay. Interesting. So what's a core temperature 15 minutes after they've gotten out where you would be alarmed?
Anything below like 101.5.
And then if, when you have a dog that is hypothermic, what's your plan?
Leave as fast as possible. And if you can, so like you obviously want to get them dry as you possibly can. So like same thing with a human, right? If you have a person that falls into water and they're soaking wet, right? And let's hypothetically say that, like it's not as easy as getting into a car in a heated blanket, right?
Right.
Like they tell you like, hey, get next to another human, get close, touch skin to skin, get yourself insulated, let your body temperature start to rebound. So what you don't want to do is like throw them into hot water. Right? Have you ever heard that? It's like, well,
Yep.
put them in the, same thing with the opposite temp
Yes.
range. Like don't take a dog that's overheating and put them in ice water.
Yes.
Same thing goes. At least from what I understand, it's like what we do is, we always carry a few dogs with us, extra dogs when we're hunting. And they just look, they sit in the kennels and they hang out while we're hunting. And if we need to exchange a dog, we do, which sometimes we do because we have a
That's
lot of
so
dogs, we want to
cool.
get them experience. And when you run into it, it's like, look, you get in the back of a truck, you try to get the dogs dried off as much as you can so you can have towels. And then you get those dogs to lay down next to each other and share body heat. That'll help the dog that's temperature's too low. You get them out of the wind, get them out of the elements, help them start to rebound that temperature. So the idea is like, I want to get that dog's temperature rebounded until the point where they're almost back at like, 102.5. And then I want to pull the other dogs away. And I want to see that dog get their
Maintain.
temperature, re yep, maintain that temperature on their own
Okay.
for the last like degree or two. And
Interesting.
so this was a lot of this knowledge is coming out of a conversation with the veterinarian that the emergency vet that we were talking to the one time that we saw it really bad. So basically we had a dog that was, I think her internal temperature was like 94, 92, low enough that I was like, this isn't right. Put it underneath my arm. It read correctly. I put it in another dog. It
Oh
read correctly.
gosh.
No, this is like 3 hours after a hunt.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
wild.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't warm that day, or it wasn't cold that day. That was why, I mean, obviously, if we're on a cold hunt and the dog's lethargic, we're just kind of like, uh-oh. But this was, it was in the 50s that day.
So how'd
Labrador.
that
She had
happen?
Cancer. Her
Interesting.
body was under too much duress, and just the work, she couldn't handle it. she couldn't regulate her body temperature anymore because
Yeah.
her all of her energy was kind of being used already, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which that's we didn't know she had cancer at the time, or anything wrong with her at the time. And that obviously caused us to go get more tests done.
Yeah.
And but that was we called the vet, and the vet's just like, if you put her in the truck, I don't think she's gonna make it here. And I was on the phone with him. My neighbor was
Damn.
pretty, he was having a tough time with it because
I
that
can
was his,
imagine.
I mean, they've been all over the country doing HRC tests, Canada multiple times, hunting. I mean,
No.
that's his girl.
Yeah.
His best friend, and so I told him, I said, I'll talk to the vet. The vet was like, I'm pretty sure she's gonna die tonight.
How terrible.
Yeah, and he was out of town. He's like, I can't get to you. He's like, so I have to give you instructions, and I'm gonna try to get another vet to show up that failed. We tried to get to an emergency vet, and they wouldn't see us. So the closest vet was far enough out of range that he was like, you can't, she'll never make that drive, I don't think. So
How's that?
yeah, it's pretty rough. But I mean, we ended up we're on an interval. We got it underneath a bunch of blankets with a few other dogs. So it's like his two other females. I brought Jaeger over. We had every dog that we had underneath these blankets. And I mean, the dogs that were under there were panting. They were
Oh
like,
my
I do not
God.
want to be under these blankets. So
Yeah.
like, talking, going back to like the testing and the obedience and all the training that you do, like it pays off when you need to tell the dog lay down and you don't get to move for an hour.
Yeah, under a hot blanket.
Yeah. Yep. And laying a male next to two females, and one of them on the other side's in heat, but we're like, we need to get everybody as close as possible. And so on an interval, we were giving her, it was either molasses or honey. I want to say it was like every 15 or 30 minutes, and then taking an intern, then taking a reading. And you could see that temperature start to climb. Right.
Wow.
He's like, don't use an electric blanket, don't use a blow dryer, right?
Yeah, you don't want it to
Put
raise too
dogs next to
fast.
her. And then he basically said, once she's at that, I think it's like 101, I want to see her rebound from 101 to 102.5. And if she can do that, then she's stable, and you're not going to, likely she doesn't have to get rushed to an ER. And so we ended up pulling that off, and her temperature rebounded, ended up taking her when we thought she was stable, get the truck warm and get her to a vet, and then have her monitored. But that was pretty scary.
I can imagine.
Yep. And so
And so
I've
that's,
seen it with Jaeger with cramping legs, same thing, where he got a little bit too cold, got after a cripple, and I couldn't get reeling back in.
Been there.
And all of a sudden you're looking at a dog that starts acting funny, and you're like, uh-oh. And you get in the boat, you
Terrifying.
drive to land, and they're like, come on, let's run a little bit. And they're like, I don't know, man, I kind of want to lay down. And you start to panic. So that definitely happens if you're not crashing them, you're not flying them. You just try to learn from other people's mistakes and not
100%.
find yourself in tricky situations. But I mean, if you're hunting in ice water with dogs and you're doing it frequently and you're in good spots and you're shooting a lot of birds, dogs are going to get cold. As soon as that ice hits the water, you could find yourself in a dangerous situation if you're not looking at times. So like
Yes, for
5 to 10 minutes, doesn't matter what the temperatures are when there's ice, sheet ice, there's no way I'm going over that. As the temperature goes back down, so does the duration. So like
That's a
I'm
great
pulling
rule of
them out.
thumb.
Yep. So I mean, think about it. It's like, what if it's sub-zero? Versus 32 degrees, like that's a big range.
That is.
There's a certain temperature. When I get in the single digits, we may not run a dog,
Yeah.
not on water. We
Yeah.
may go hunt fields. We can still
It's
shoot them
nice
out
to
of
have that
fields.
ability. Yeah.
Yeah. So it just depends. So
So, did that influence your decision at all to switch from a short hair to a wire hair with your next dog?
absolutely. Yeah. I when the temperature gets pretty low and you start going like, all right, well, put all this training into you. And for the thing that I can do regularly, I mean, I can go 15 minutes away and go hunt.
Yeah,
on any
that's so
night that
cool.
I want to.
Duck hunt is what you're referring to.
Duck hunting, yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard looking at a dog that you put all that work into and being like,
Oh,
sorry, buddy.
yeah, no. I
Meanwhile,
hate
I
that
know I'm
for
about to go shoot 20, 30 birds with a group of guys and have an absolute blast doing it,
it. Yeah.
but we're
That's.
rotating labs at that time. So you're like, well, I love going on the road. I love upland hunting, and I love hunting in early season, but if I'm doing a lot of late season duck hunting and goose hunting, I'm going to want to have something with a little bit more durability in the water to cold temperatures. So the wire hair was the obvious choice because I still like upland hunting. And, a lot of guys that are running wire hairs are, hunting sheet ice, just really successful. I think I talked to Ryan McIntosh, who teaks out of, that's my wire hair, Southern Wires Teak. So Ryan hunts his girls in ice water, and he doesn't even put a vest on them up until they get to the point where they're sheet ice. So it's got to be sub 32 degrees, and that's when he'll start thinking about putting a vest on him.
That's
So, I mean, so
cool.
far Teak does great. I mean, it's a
Yeah.
noticeable difference. I mean,
Really?
yeah, I had him on a downed bird. So we have Phragmites that's overrun our duck club, and it's treacherous. It's so hard for those dogs to work through. I mean, if your dog can duck search there, they will do it anywhere in the country.
Really?
It's like little bamboo shoots, and they're quarter inch apart. I can't even walk through it most of the time.
Really?
Yeah, which is also
Interesting.
dangerous because if the dogs get back there and get stuck, I might not be able to get them.
Oh, that's terrifying.
It is. So that in combination with the mud, and it feels like quicksand when you step in it. You just go down to your knees immediately. It's horrible.
Awful.
So that's what the dogs are primarily used for. But I think I had them in the water for, maybe when we woke up, maybe it was like 30 degrees. So light bit of ice, but we have moving water. So, that helps. So if you have moving water and wind, it won't freeze over, but it can be below freezing. And, maybe we shot a few mallards that day, and one of them had sailed behind us, which is just, I mean, it's just super thick back there. And, when they're coming over the top of us, we shoot them and then they sail behind us. And so I was like, all right, well, time to earn your keep, little buddy. And you just work them, you just help them learn how to maneuver through it. So it's like they're swimming up and they have to break through a wall of like little bamboo shoots. Right. So because it
Weird.
grows up to a certain depth, and that depth happens to be deeper than, as they raise the water up a little bit too, because we have a dam. And so he can't touch. So he has to learn how to
Swim through that.
swim through that. And it's all muscle. He has to just kick and nose through it until he can start to pull it away with his paws. And, so maybe he's fully submerged for 10 minutes, and I'm looking at my watch and my neighbor's going, hey, kind of pointing at his wrist, like, it's time to wrap it up. He doesn't have that duck. And I'm like, man, I can hear him in there and he's on it. I can tell just by the way he's smelling. He's got the Hoover going. You know what I'm talking about? And the dogs start to get birdy. I'm like, just a little bit longer and he'll have it. And I look and he's going, come on, let's go. All right. I pull him back in and he's cold, but I feel underneath him like 2 minutes later and he's warm. And he's not wearing a vest that day either. And I'm like, man, his fur's wet, but underneath, underneath his legs, on his back end, it's warm. His armpits are warm. He's happy. He's got his tail going. He's ready to go again. And you're like, man, this is only a handful of minutes after I'd got him out of the water. Well, I knew
That's a
Jaeger
relief.
because I've done that same thing in the same temperature in the same location with Jaeger, and he has not recovered that quickly.
Interesting. So
Right. Whereas,
do you start a timer every time the dog gets in the water when it's cold like that?
yeah, I wear a watch. So
Yeah,
as
I
soon as
wear a
they leave the
watch.
ramp, I look at my watch. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yep. And you just kind of take a mental note. It's like hunting with other guys who have dogs. When the dog goes into the water when it's real cold, we'll just call the timeout.
Oh, that's smart. That way multiple people are thinking about it.
Hey, 752, remember that. And so we'll start. If I'm in the water, maybe I'm in the water because I'm helping him work through stick cover or something, or I'm just standing there to hang out because I like going out there. And I'll call out like, hey, where are we at? And the guys will be like, 7:55. Like, damn, it's only been 3 minutes. Like, I'm freezing.
Interesting. Okay. That's super helpful. I wish I would have known that
Yeah.
earlier.
But if you're handling your dog, it's your responsibility to call that out. Like if you want people to remember the time and
Yes.
your dog hits the water, you look at your watch and say 7:52, remember that.
Yep.
And the guys, no, nobody's going to be like, no,
Right.
good luck, start a timer. You know what I'm saying? If you're
Right.
like, hey, I'm trying to keep them, in the water for only a handful of minutes at a
Yeah.
time.
Yeah.
So,
That's super
yep. And
smart.
then, yep, you just call it out. And then sometimes, you just look at this last week, my neighbor's dog Shay was on an ice retrieve and it was like 60, 70 yards, just nothing but ice. She had to break
Right.
ice the whole way. And she got halfway there. And we were like, let's turn her around. She's not making 50% of the way there. We're at 8 minutes. She
Yeah.
ain't getting there.
Yeah.
So we recalled her back in, started the grill up. We don't have a heater, we just have a grill. So we start the grill up and then, you start to smell burning bacon and then the dogs are like, hey, I'm hanging out in here for a little bit because I'm gonna
Yeah.
get a treat. It's real easy to keep a dog inside the blind when they smell bacon.
That's
And
hilarious.
yeah, so then she gets warmed up and then she's off of my end and I send her. So I send her on a back and she swims through the broken ice. And then she breaks ice a few times, she turns around and looks, no, back.
Yeah.
And she turns around again, no, back. And then she's like, all right, well, I guess we're doing it. And she swims the rest of the way, breaks ice for the other,
Got
remaining
it.
40 yards and picks her bird up, swims all the way back in,
Very cool.
So yeah, and if they swim in zigzags, then they can, or they get through a sheet of ice and get into a pool, they can look for an easier route and then not find it, get a little panicky, which
Yep.
is what I think you ran into.
Yep. Terrifying.
Yeah, so in those situations, it's just like, all right, like at what point do I go get them versus letting them figure it out? Because if they get a little cold, I'm like, man, that's kind of scary. Like they'll start paying attention a little bit better,
Yeah, I wish I would have had an alarm set or, acknowledged my time because obviously when you're in the midst of that and seeing your dog stuck, it feels like a century, and I have really no idea how long it actually was.
Yeah, when you see a dog, get hypothermia, it just kind of changes the way you behave.
Yeah,
Like
for
my
sure.
dogs don't get in the water without me looking at my watch. It's habit now. I have to do
That's
it.
smart.
And I never did it up until that day. And then all of a sudden now it's like ingrained in me. When I
Right.
hear the dog splash, even when it's not my dog, I look at my watch.
Right. How long are they going to be out there for?
Yep.
And you know,
And a handful of us do it, so it helps.
it's a little bit different, obviously, when we're in North Carolina and we're not killing a lot of ducks and a lot of it's swampy where they're going to not be submerged and stuff. But it's an important lesson if you're going to go hunt somewhere else where you're going to have ice on water and a lot more swimming and such.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, hunting the further north that you go, you're hunting really cold, moving water and high
Yeah.
wind temps.
Yeah.
If you get a chance to hunt with, guys who are waterfowling in the cold and, North Dakota guys or Canada
Yep.
guys, and they're a wealth of information.
I can imagine.
I'm
Yeah.
probably not talking about cold weather strategies for hunting dogs from a person who lives in Mexico, right?
You
Because
go. Yep.
when you go up north, hunt with, guys who live it every
Yes.
day and
For sure.
just watch how they operate.
Yeah.
How do they keep their dog warm? How they keep them dry?
Yep.
How long the dog's in the water before they call them back? It's
Yep.
kind of like, if you're learning how to grill. It's like the guy who's always the pit boss who's kind of sitting around grilling chicken and he doesn't have a timer going. He just knows, just start
Taking
looking at
notes.
him. It's like,
Yep.
yeah. You learn a lot just observing.
I can imagine. Any other th things you've noticed as a difference between having a short hair and a wire hair?
Obviously the wire hairs get a lot hotter, a lot faster.
Really?
So temperature ranges. Yeah, I just think, short hairs, in my experience, have just performed better in the heat. As far as like, all things remain equal. It's
Yes.
obviously you can condition, like Ryan lives in Texas. His dogs handle the heat much better than Teak does, right? Because
Fair, that's
he they
fair.
live and breathe that desert. And then I would venture to say that, they could probably run with Jaeger. So like, what are they acclimated to? How much work are they doing in those temperatures? And it's kind of, it's like young kids, when you start running in the heat, like really practicing. Maybe you're doing sports in the heat. They don't know how to like get out of the sun and go into the shade, you know, like lift their arms up and get wind going over their skin. You
Interesting.
know, so dogs
I'm
will pick that
surprised to
type of
hear
stuff
that
up.
though. I wouldn't have thought that wire hair would make that big of a difference in the heat.
It definitely makes a difference. Like I can notice it. So if I take them, you know, after hunting season, maybe they're just on kind of couch mode. And then, you know, you get into training season, you know, and all of a sudden in Illinois, you'll just hit 100% humidity, 100 degrees outside.
We know all
Just
about
like,
that in North Carolina.
yeah. And then all of a sudden you realize like, whoa, these dogs are not acclimated to this temperature. So
Interesting.
Jaeger will rebound faster than Teak will.
That's fair. That makes sense.
Right? Makes perfect sense. You know, so I just make sure I've got a fan from when I'm working and high temperature and then ice. So I've got a dog box, an Owens box that has a top lid that comes up. If I'm working, it's 100 degrees. I'll throw ice in that top box.
That's cool.
And then
That's
I
a good
put
idea.
air. So like it'll just drip cold water, you know, in Jaeger's kennel because my box is angled. And you know, and then it just keeps those boxes nice and cool enough to where the dogs can rebound their temperature and get comfortable, and they can sit in 90 degrees, parking in the shade. Don't park in the sun,
Yeah, of course
right?
not.
Park in the shade, and when the sun moves, start your truck up. Even if you have all your stakes and stuff out, just move
Move
it
it.
again. So
Yeah, that's
some
important
of that
around here
stuff
for
is
sure.
yeah. So you'll see those same problems in, you know, in the cold too. It's like, hey, getting your dog out in the sun a little bit where they're not in the wind, it helps. You
That
know,
makes sense.
so in the summer, it's the opposite. I'm trying to keep them in the shade, keep them out of the sun. So.
All right. Do you want to talk a little bit about NAVDA?
Sure. Yeah. Nabbed in the context of.
Let's talk about NAVDA in the context of breeding.
Okay. Yeah. Where do you want to start? Just on just the idea of like testing system and okay. Yeah, so so I think generally everybody's on board with the idea of you know, collection of data, measurement, and then improvement, right? So and then, you know, generally if you throw out the idea of making a data-driven decision, people generally like smile and nod, right? Like, yeah, measure and improve, smile and nod, data-driven decisions, smile and nod, right? Like, most people are on board with that. And so the question is, like, how do you do that, you know, in terms of breeding, right? And so when you're talking about breeding dogs, you know, so like, what measurable things, can you collect and what measurable things can you make decisions off of, right? And so, and then how's that system repeat itself? And so I think like NABDA specifically, you know, in software, you have this term, it's called garbage in, garbage out, right? Meaning, you know, if you collect poor data, if you collect bad data, and you put it into any software, you're going to get out bad outcomes. It doesn't matter what it does, right? If you feed it garbage, it's going to output garbage, right? It's kind of like AI. Right now, I think everybody's talking about AI as this solution to a lot of problems. But if you train AI models on bad data, it's just going to output you bad stuff. And I think we've seen that where, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they hallucinate maybe, you know, where the data that you train them on, I've trained AI systems before. So we were doing that, you know, maybe a decade ago, doing all sorts of interesting things for hedge funds. And so, yeah, it high quality data is needed for that first step, right? And so system like NAVDA, they spend a lot of time and energy on their judges program, right? They've thought through their testing system really well. And, you know, as a byproduct, they have like reasonably high quality collection of data, right? And it's relatively consistent, you know, and I go and I look at all the tests for all the dogs that I've seen run or that I've handled, pretty accurate. You know, I'm not getting upset at a judge, you know, and hey, look, maybe the judge changes the environment as a byproduct of, so I'll give you a great example. My dad ran his dog out of Jaeger Moose, and dog likes to run. I mean, he wants the second that you let that leash loose, he is hauling. And we ran a bunch of dogs towards a tree line. Moose is the last dog to run, and
You're
it
talking
was
about
real close.
tracking?
Yep,
Okay.
tracking. Yep, thank you. So we're running these dogs through tree line, and we just get too close to the road for comfort. And the judge basically walked over and said, "Hey, I got to make a call. It's too close to the road for this dog." So he's going to see a different picture
Than everyone
than the
else.
nine dogs that went before him. Now, the picture that he saw was about four times the open field,
Oh, God.
right? So, look, genetically,
Yes.
this dog has an affinity for running,
Yep.
and he took off like just a bat out of hell
I can
and didn't look
imagine.
back. Yep,
Yeah.
and he started running into a search. Now, people could get upset about like the testing system and the whiteout didn't get a fair shake, but he should just do it, right?
Right.
Like it doesn't matter where he's doing it. Like, look, if he's tracking a wheat field, if he's tracking in the heat, and like all of these things are going to be different for every single dog in across America. Like
For sure.
if I'm testing in Texas or New Mexico, I'm not getting that beautiful grass that I get in
No.
Missouri. It's got nice moisture on it, right? Like, look, we've got like the holy grail of setups at Missouri Uplands chapter. We have everything there on site, and the grounds are immaculate, right? So like, hey, he had
It
a lot of
sets the
field in
dogs
front
up
of
for
him.
success for sure.
Yeah. And hey, look, there was a presentation of a field, and the dog decided not to track. He decided to party, right? And had a fun time doing it. And hey, look, I mean, they gave him an accurate score on his track. I think it was a two. He got a two on a track. And and then we went home. It's like, well, that's unfortunate. He might have done better if he would have had a different environment, right? Or the environment was structured. You know what I'm saying? Like, hey, box him in with pine trees and he's gonna run straighter. But you don't get pine trees in real life. So like that was an accurate assessment for him at that point in time. Now circle back to, maybe it's in 2 years, maybe he'll track more. It's like he'll learn that skill. But right now he likes running.
I don't blame him for that.
So it was accurate, very accurate. I think you have to like really, you have to look at the collection of the data and just say like, hey, is it reasonably fair what we're asking of the dog? Right. And I think NAPTA does a really good job of doing that. They also do, I think, a really great job of saying like, what am I seeing? Right. When you're talking about evaluating things like cooperation, right? Where if you look at Jaeger's scores, he's never scored anything but a three in cooperation. It's barely hanging on, right? We just get above the bar, but that's accurate for him, right? It's also very generous, in my opinion, but they're fair. Yeah, I don't think I've seen judges give him a bad shake. I've seen environments that frustrate people,
Of
but I've
course.
never seen the judging frustrate people, right? If you can
That's a
separate
very
those two
accurate
things
description, yeah.
logically, then I think you can understand it a little bit more. The
Yeah,
judges,
for
in my
sure.
opinion, do a great job. I think it's a lot of, a lot behind the program and just the caliber of people that they're recruiting to that program. And then, you have to pass dogs in utility if you want to judge on a regular interval. I use utility and maybe UPT. But I mean, these people are, they're dedicating a lot of their time and energy. You have a finite amount of free time. A lot of them are working
Absolutely.
jobs, maybe full-time dog trainers, maybe they're lawyers, right? Like Desiree comes to our chapter. She's a judge. She's a lawyer, and
Unbelievable,
she's a mother.
really.
And yeah, I mean, how much free time do you really have to dedicate? And I mean, so they do a really great job of just like recruiting good people. Mike Medusi
Of
running
course.
Ugly Dog Hunting right now, right? Like running his own business that he just purchased. Like that's not stressful and busy at all, right? I had just awesome experiences over the years, like Tracy Nelson, again, right? Like another extremely busy person, great judge. She handled me in utility, and was just like, she kept me leveled out.
Mike was my utility person that kept me grounded.
Because you get in those tests, you go, "Oh boy, this dog's really turned up today." And she's like, "Yeah, maybe I would, maybe I'll handle him away from that area." Not saying do it, but I'm saying it's in your best interest, So just being able to then, just kind of talk you down a little bit and then help give you the right advice. And then also while they're doing that, you've got a crew of judges behind you who are, helping evaluate the dog and scoring stuff, which I'm not a judge, so I can't really speak to exactly what they're doing. But all I can tell you is that what I see on the output side is,
Great.
in my opinion, very fair, very accurate. They tease out what they're seeing in a good way. So you can tell they put a lot of work in that program. So
For
like,
sure.
so that's the collection side.
Okay.
So now we go into like the measurement side,
Yeah.
right? And so, Navda, you have prizes. So no prize, prize one, prize two, prize three. Prize one being the highest, three being the lowest, right? Where all of a sudden we start to take different measurements. So like maybe you get measured on nose, search, cooperation, right? And all of those things have a bar. So each level has a bar that you have to score over. And then the combination of all of those will give you both a score and a prize, right? And that's the measurement side. And then you have the improve side, which is, you could talk about improving and training, right? So that's one aspect, right? Being able to say, okay, well, hey, look, I went to the field with this dog a few times and the dog didn't have any steadiness coming in. And so as a byproduct, I came back and I refined how I was training, how I was thinking about training. Maybe I just, I was able to fit the training to the dog a little bit more with more time, less stress. Dog comes back and scores phenomenally better in the areas that it didn't before, right? That's on the improvement side. Then you can look at the improvement side and the concept of breeding, right? Meaning, so I was using Fred Rice as an example if we were on here, right? It's like, you'll get some of Fred's, I've been around a lot of his dogs. They have good noses. They're pointing, they're sexy, they have great noses. Generally, I'm not seeing those dogs blow up in any situation. It could be hot, right? We could be in the desert, we could be in Alaska, it could be snowing, it could be raining. Those dogs are pointing, right? They have an extraordinarily durable genetic characteristic where there are other dogs and other breeds that don't quite have that amount of durability. It's like all of a sudden when the dogs are running in the, an area that doesn't have as favorable scenting conditions, they're not pointing as well, right? If the bird scent isn't as strong, right, that's going to affect their pointing scores. And so, you start to look at, you stick two dogs together and the children are going to be a byproduct of the genetics that get passed from mom and dad. And those genetics are a byproduct of their grandparents and so on and so forth, right? And so all of a sudden, when you look at a pedigree, you start to say, like, these dogs are tested all over the country, right? Missouri, Texas, Maine, right? If you'll look at any one pedigree, those dogs could be located all over the place. I mean, Jaeger has dogs all over the country, right? He did one breeding. And so it's, when you start to look at that and then, just go back in time, look at the test data. NABDA has public test data. It's awesome. Go use it. It's a great resource. Start saying, what time of year were they tested? How old were they tested? Right? You can go look at Weather Channel data. It's free. It's on the internet. What was the temperature? You can look at every one of those dogs. It's not easy to do it, but the data's there. And so that will give you an understanding of like how durable some of the behaviors are, right?
That's a great way to define
Yep.
them.
And so, in a certain kennels, you're going to see like extraordinarily durable pointing scores. And these dogs do very well in a lot of different environments. You're going to see extraordinarily durable cooperation scores and other lines of dogs, right? Like Teak has got a ton of cooperation, like more than I'm used to, almost annoyingly cooperative.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so I'm really getting used to that because I don't, when we're hunting, I just, and all of a sudden his head pops up and he's in tune with me all the time. If I'm looking for wherever Jaeger's running at on the horizon and I turn and start walking right, all of a sudden I notice like, oh, hey, look, Teak's in front of me again. Right? Autopilot a lot of this time.
Big difference.
And so if you go and you look around his pedigree and you start to look in the back of his pedigree, all of a sudden you can start to see consistencies. You can see some inherent patterns and the dogs are all over the place. I mean, he's out of a dog
Interesting.
named Thunder Hills Hardwired Hank, who's on in a completely different area than Ryan's bitch Cora. So, she's in Texas, obviously. She ran in very hot temperatures while Hank, and very dry temperatures while Hank may not have, and so, and then the dogs that made them and so on and so forth. When you breed two dogs together, you have a dog whose pedigree and scores show a consistent lack of something, the idea that it's going to go away and the progeny is.
Silly.
Yeah. It's a low probability outcome.
So do you think that NAVDA in general is suitable for predicting, looking at test scores is suitable for predicting what you're going to see in offspring?
I would say you can see trends, right? So there's like correlation and causation, and so I think there's a lot of factors to test scores, one of them being handlers, right? So like what
Absolutely.
I can tell you is if you take a dog who's high performer, we'll say it's like a utility prize one dog, and he came out of two parents that were utility prize one dogs, and then their parents were all utility prize one dogs, and you hand that to a person who handles very well, right? Right, we'll say on both sides of the pedigree, and you take a person who's fairly experienced with the testing system, fairly experienced with pointing dogs, you're going to get a good outcome, right? But if you take a Chihuahua and you breed it to, we'll say a Golden Doodle, it doesn't matter what the handler that you
You're not
hand
going
it
to get your
to,
prize for
it's going to be tough, right? And like when we say it on the extremes, like it makes it easier to rationalize. The question is like, how much does the handler actually matter? And then, so I mean, just look at the family, like look at the brothers and sisters. This is why the varied entry for the natural ability test is awesome. It's well done because it doesn't take an extraordinary handler
To be able to
to prep
assess
a
a
dog,
dog,
right?
I guess my big concern would be when we're looking at breeding dogs based on NAVDA scores, would be to take the mediocre dog and to place it with a very experienced handler and to say that this is an exceptional dog because it was with a handler that really showed off its abilities and knew how to play the game. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I can tell you, if that happens, like let's say hypothetically say that you have a dog who's not quite at the genetic caliber, say that another dog is, and it gets bred a lot. Like not all those handlers that they're going to are going to be professionals, and so that'll tease itself out the next generation.
I gotcha.
And then those dogs have to be selected for breeding in order for that to, so I mean, I generally think that, it's not as big of a deal, and there's only really so much that a professional, I mean, on an unlimited budget, sure, but most of us aren't working with that type of,
Fair.
yep. So I think it happens a lot less than we think it does.
Okay.
But also, hey, look, we have good dogs. Like some of those dogs in the 90s, we're not operating with the same level of dog, right? Like, I haven't seen a dog fight in the field in I don't know how long, knock on wood,
Interesting, huh?
right? I mean, some of the dogs in the 90s, they were sharp. I remember picking a dog up to put him, my uncle's like, hey, put him back in the kennel. And I'm like, dude, I'm scared that this dog's gonna kill me. Don't
Really?
touch me. Yep, stay away from me. And look, hey, I watched our dog get into a fight, two of them, with a, I want to say it was a Rottweiler or a Doberman outside my front yard.
Oh God.
And then another was with one of my uncle's dogs in the field. But I mean, you get them around the tailgate after a hunt and they start taking cheap shots. Right. And it wasn't a like, will it happen? It's a when it happens.
Interesting.
They're sharper dogs. Also, the skills and abilities, like the whole package combined, they're just better dogs. Like they're smaller. A lot of the dogs that I was seeing when I was younger, I think that was regional too, had something to do with it. But, I mean, so the dogs have definitely evolved. I think for the better, me
That's good
personally.
to hear for sure.
I see a lot of great dogs.
Do you think there's any, and this is just your opinion, because you spend so much time hunting as well as playing the game, do you think there's any issues, I guess is maybe the word I'm looking for, with people breeding for the tests and not for hunting?
I think using the test as a standard of measurement is it right? So like measure and improve, everybody nods their head and smiles, right? So like when somebody starts operating like that, it's kind of, we can't be upset because like all of us collectively agree that measure, improve seems to be a reasonable way to make good decisions, right? Anybody who's doing anything at a high level can agree that
Mm-hmm.
that's a good way to do th the question is like, what are you collecting? What system are you using to collect it? How are you measuring it? And then how specifically are you improving it? Those are your own personal standards,
Yeah.
right? So like the German system has their own standards.
Yep.
Specifically, your dog has to pass tests at a certain level with a certain score, and then they're
Yeah.
eligible for breeding, right? We don't have that if you're like an AKC registered and NABDA registered dog. Maybe you participate in a group, so like NAPA or something, where they have some standards that they, if you want to be a part of the group, then you breed to the standards. But like, generally, if people are breeding specifically for test scores, I don't know how much of that's happening. I think there's a lot of people who hunt, and that's all relative, right? So like, there's guys out there who don't play the games, who will probably never be on a podcast with you, who out hunt me by a factor of 100.
Of
And
course,
they
yeah.
probably know, you know what I'm saying? So like,
Yeah, of course.
there's the extremes, right? It's like, hey, that guy probably knows what a good dog's built like because they're just
Yes,
pounding them every day.
exactly. Yes.
Now he may not demand the level of cooperation and obedience that we do. So maybe there's areas where his judgment may be lacking, right? But like, he can tell you what a good dog's built like because
For
he hunts
sure.
them. It's like, that dog's pads blow off, that dog's, I get dogs out of this
That's the
kennel and
stuff
all of a
I'm curious
sudden,
about, yeah.
right? But it's all, it's all a give and a take, right? It's like
Yep.
no one person can be absolutely perfect, so you'll have the outliers, you have the people who are like really into the sports, right? They're more sporting dogs, right? And then you have the people who are like more into hunting, right? And so like, because there's only a finite amount of supply, there's going to be overlap,
Yeah.
right? And so by nature, you'll get both of those parties of dogs hands on the various genetics over time, and they'll either like them or they won't
Yeah.
for specifically what they're doing. I think it's the more tragedy is when we're breeding specifically for, we have purpose driven or purpose built dogs. And when your market specifically is not for people who will use them in
First,
those purposes,
yes.
right? Like, hey, look, if you want to do NABDA, if that's your thing, or you want to do the Verso Honey Dog Federation, that's your thing, or field trials, whatever, right? Use the dog and fulfill its genetics in a good
Yep.
way. And then you want to hunt a handful of times a year. Okay, cool. You don't want to do ice water with your short hair. Cool.
Yep.
Right. I'm not going to knock you. Even if you
Heck
want to
no.
breed, I'm not going to knock you. And for the guy who's hunting 60 day seasons and traveling all over the place and just burning his dogs up and they're
Yep.
living their best life, like,
Yep.
I'm not going to tell that guy what to do.
Heck no.
Where, right, I think it becomes a problem is all of a sudden when the market of hunters is relatively small, right? Especially people for any given breed.
Yep.
When all of a sudden we expand that market to,
Owners.
people who don't understand the genetics, what they're used for, and that's just where you get bad matchups. Where a lot of dogs end up in rescues. This dog chews my house up. It's like, well, yeah, man. Like most of the time, these dogs are running like a few miles a night. Just, and that's just what they're doing when they're trying to figure out where to go to the bathroom. They're putting on 2 miles figuring out where to pee. I think that's a much bigger lookout for. And the good question is like, what happens, like if we didn't meet the demand, right? With the supply, if we didn't meet the demand, if everybody bred less. Right. Would that be a positive or negative impact? Right. So like, well, less dogs means I have less diversity of choices. Right. And so like, would that be good or bad? And then how specifically would we measure that? Right. So like, hey, short hairs are very performant, especially in these versatile games. They score very well, especially in NABDA. I mean, if you go look at short hairs, the next breed is the wire hairs, and so on and so forth. Like, there's a lot of short hairs that get past the very highest levels of NABDA Invitational and getting prize one utilities. It's a very strong breed. And so they're also the dog that you see on commercials and on dog food bags, right? And there's people jogging with them. Like, I want to get a German short hair as a friend for my 1 year old kid. You're like, oh my God, that sounds like a horrible idea in an
know.
apartment, right?
If
So like,
anyone needs help reaffirming that, I've got a whole podcast on the GSP that you could definitely send to a friend who wants to get a short hair for their
Right.
child.
Yeah, but I mean, just some absolutely bizarre, reasoning behind why they're getting the dog, and it doesn't make any sense. But like behind all that too, it's still an incredibly strong breed. So the question is like, how do I measure strength over time? Like all of a sudden, will the increase of the demand make the dogs less performant as a byproduct of unstructured breeding, right? It's like I'm trying to breed to meet demand, therefore the standards get lower. Theoretically, do they? You know, I mean, there's all these questions that you could answer if you were willing to sit and collect the data and then just, you know, with an unbiased eye, just look at it and say, doesn't seem like it's having much effect, right? I mean, you could look at the Labradors. I think there's a lot of issues that people have identified in the Labradors, and they get bred a lot. But I have hunted with some of the best dogs in my life that have been made in the last 20 years, 10 years even. They keep getting better, you know? So you're like, now I think
Interesting.
that the great dogs are carried by way of a handful of breeders and a handful of genetic,
I would
you
agree
know?
with that.
You know, where I think a lot of the people that you'll see that are breeding volume, those dogs just fizzle out. You don't see them pop up on the pedigrees. I mean, you're going to see dogs like, you know, you go into the pedigrees, look at NABDA, right? You're going to see, what do you see? Sharpshooter's Mane in black. Try to find pedigrees without that dog on it. Freight Train Mason, real sharp dog, try to find pedigrees without him on it, right? These are dogs that have scored incredibly well. You know, they're really high performers. They produce really well. You know, and as a byproduct, you see them all over the place, and you still consistently see them, and you will consistently see them for the
For a
next
long
20
time.
years.
Yeah, for
It's kind
sure.
of like you go find a pedigree that doesn't have, you know, Potsiepen on it at some level, Orson, or you know, there's a variety of different dogs that were just, they were so performant, they stood the test of time, and those are the dogs that make up our. So, you know, the question isn't like, should or shouldn't somebody? It's like, what does the breed look like in 20 years, and which dogs make it and which dogs don't?
And
You know,
that'll
and then
weed
can we
itself
speed
out, I
that
guess.
process? Yeah. And so, like, if you believe that the dogs are evolving in a good direction and that the dogs are definitely more performant and you know, a higher caliber than they were, how do we speed those cycles up is maybe a better question.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so, like, I think too, if you're not crashing them, you're not flying them. Like, if you're doing it, you're going to make mistakes and bad
I
stuff's
need to
going to
use
happen.
that phrase more. That sounds like something Grayson would say, and I haven't heard him say that. We're going to have to talk about that.
He can use it for free.
I'll let him know. Awesome. Anything else you want to cover before we close out?
No, I think we went quite the distance.
It was fun.
So
I learned a lot. This was really enjoyable. I'm glad you took the time to do this. I know you're busy and I really appreciate that.
yeah, absolutely. You know, I am building some software to help create some observability in the breeds. So, you know, maybe the next time we pop on, you know, I can demo it to you and kind of explain to you how to, you know, how to measure higher quality measurement and improvements on, you know, on data that's not exclusively one testing system versus the other. So.
There you go. Yeah. If you found any of this interesting, definitely stay tuned because we'll have Brandon back on to talk more about what he's got in the works. And it is super exciting. And I can't wait to share that with everyone. So that'll be sometime soon, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Brandon. I really appreciate it. If anyone has any questions, what would be the best way for someone to reach out to you?
Oh man. Join the NABDA chapter. Join Missouri Uplands NABDA chapter
There
and you will find me.
you go. That's perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Enjoy your night, and I will talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Emily.
Night.
See ya.